Hello and welcome to New Books Network. I'm your host in Russian and Eurasian Studies, Philip Balgach. Joining me today is Willard Sunderland to talk about his newest book, The Baron's Cloak, A History of the Russian Empire in War and Revolution. Dr. Sunderland is an associate professor of history at the University of Cincinnati. He is the author of Taming the Wild Field, Colonization and Empire on the Russian Steppe, and the co-editor of a book called Peopling the Russian Periphery, Borderland Colonization in Eurasian History. The Baron's Cloak is a history of the late Russian Empire. While the book is presented as a biography of Baron von Ungern, it is actually an in-depth look at the Russian Empire, with Baron von Ungern playing a central role in guiding us from the west to the east. By following von Ungern's life, we are able to follow the expansion of the Russian Empire towards Asia. Baron's Cloak is a story of the interaction between the Russian Empire and the people on the borderlands. It is also a history of cosmopolitan Russia. The Baron's life, who was a Tsarist military officer, is an interesting insight into the multinational society that the Russian Empire was. And here to talk about the book Baron's Cloak is Dr. Willard Sunderland. Willard, hello and welcome to the program.
Hi there.
Before we jump into the book, we'd love to hear you tell us a little bit about yourself and how you came to Russian history.
Well, first of all, thanks very much for having me on the show. It's a real pleasure to have the chance to talk a little bit about my work. I think my story, as far as coming to Russian history is concerned, is pretty typical for people of my generation in the U.S. I grew up as a boy, always knowing or hearing about the Soviet Union, and as it became a little bit more thoughtful about things as a teenager, it seemed like the Soviet Union was everywhere. This was the very late 1970s and early 1980s. And by the time I started college in 1983, I was just very curious about this country that we heard about all the time, but that and that it was obviously our enemy in a very basic sense, and yet a place that I barely understood. And so when I got to college, I got excited about studying Russian. I learned that if I kept things up in my Russian program, I might have a chance to actually participate in a student exchange in the Soviet Union. And my college years turned into the perestroika years of tremendous, really exciting change in the Soviet Union that also opened up incredible opportunities for me because I was an okay student, but I certainly wasn't at the top of the heap. But I was saved by a warming in U.S.-Soviet relations because they expanded the number of U.S. students that could go on these exchanges. I barely qualified, and by 1987, I was on a semester-long exchange program in Moscow. And it was really after that experience that I realized I couldn't really turn away from the place. It was so absorbing. There were so many questions. There was so much that was different about it, and yet eerily similar in some ways, too, that I came away wanting to understand the country and the culture on a deeper level, and it just seemed like there was nowhere to go but history, because one way or the other, it was the historical context that provided at least some kind of explanation for what seemed to be the tremendous curiosity, complexity of what I was seeing when I was a student there. So after that, I got excited and thinking about just about any way to stay in touch with the Soviet Union. For a period, I worked on these fishing ships in the North Pacific during a time of joint venture operations between the Soviet government and an American company that was bringing Soviet fishermen over to American waters to work with American fishermen. They needed Americans who knew a little bit of Russian and were foolish enough to sign up for months at sea on a Soviet trawler. And I did that. It really improved my Russian, and it also gave me another look at the complexities of Soviet life in that time. And then after that, I followed things a little bit further and worked for ACTR, which is a major exchange organization in D.C., and from there, I ended up in graduate school at Indiana. So that's the short story of how I got there. I think more than anything, I ended up pursuing Russian history because of the fascination produced by the hostility of the Cold War, the hostility and the mystery of the Cold War that made me really think about the place.
your interests originally seem to be have been in the Cold War, but you came to write this book about Russian Empire. This is your newest book, Baron's Cloak, is very much a story of the breadth of the Russian Empire. So I'm wondering if you could talk about how it is that you came to write this book and how it is that you came to choose your hero of the book. His name is Baron von Ergen, and I'm wondering if you could just talk about both the hero and how it is that he wraps into the context of what is empire, what is the Russian Empire.
Sure. Well, you know, it's so interesting. Even though it was the broader context of the Cold War that got me excited about learning more about Russia, as I got into formally studying the place and then followed through on my initial experiences living and working there, what really fascinated me was the breadth and diversity of the country. Obviously, the Soviet Union was at the time by far the largest country in the world. And looking back through history, the Russian Empire, too, was an enormous state, second only to the British Empire at the height of its grandeur in the late 19th century. And I had always wondered about how such an enormous space could come to be. As to say, how the different regions could fit together, what histories put them in the same historical trajectory, what connections were forged between the different peoples and cultures of the area. So even when I was an undergraduate student, sort of stumbling around for just about anything that could connect me to Russia, it was always more than anything a fascination with the size and diversity of the place. So as I went into graduate school, those became dominant guides for me in my research. And my first book, which came out of my dissertation, was focused on problems of empire building. I studied the history of Russian colonization and settlement in a huge and very important region in the history of the Russian Empire, the steppes of the Russian South, north of the Black and Caspian Seas, over centuries. It's a massive process that has an awful lot in common with processes of colonization in other places. And I took on the story across centuries, painting a pretty big tableau of all the different mechanisms that came together, both on the ground and in boardrooms way back in the capital, to create this imperial region through settlement. But as I was following that history, what I realized was that I wasn't really answering this other question that began nagging at me, which is how the whole thing worked at the individual level for concrete people. I obviously had people in my story, and some of the personalities I came across in writing that book were truly remarkable, but I didn't pause much to unpack them or think too deeply about how they would have looked at the empire they were participating in, or in some cases directly putting together. So as I thought about what I would do next, I wanted to try and get into that question. And in a very basic sense, after publishing that first book, which is called Taming the Wild Field, in the early 2000s, I began just sort of strolling through new readings that led me into imperial persons, or imperial personalities. I didn't necessarily have any one particular person in mind, but then I did, I guess to my good fortune as an academic, because it raises so many questions, to my good fortune, I did stumble into Baron Ergen. And the reason why I say it's good fortune is because he really is an imperial person who opens up so many intriguing questions about the empire, both in a very general sense, but also specifically in his time. His story gave me the chance to work on something that was really not at all a part of my first book. If the first book that I wrote was focused overwhelmingly on what brought the empire together, Ungern's story was not just about how the empire worked as a whole, but also why, in fact, in this particular historical moment, the moment of his life, why the empire began to shake tremendously and ultimately spun into pieces before being reconstituted in a very different way, eerily continuous in some respects, but ultimately a different way by the Bolsheviks. So his story was both about the empire coming together and falling apart, and it was about big processes, but also a single person. And so it intrigued me from the start.
Ergen is born in modern-day Austria, and your book encompasses Russia's connection to Europe and to the Far East, to China, to Mongolia, to Siberia. So let's start with Europe and how it is that Ungern comes to be born in Austria, but becomes a officer for the Russian Tsar, and we'll go from there into the empire expanding eastward.
Right. Yeah, well, Ungern was hardly representative. There is no single person who can speak for all the complexities of the empire, and I try to make that clear in the book. But one of my goals in choosing Ungern is to get inside the basic material components of imperial living, of making a life within the empire. And when you do that, you run into all kinds of people who, like Ungern, bring together a variety of cultures and habits of mobility, a familiarity with living in different regions and somehow combining them into some sort of broader way of operating within imperial space. And Ungern belonged to an extremely privileged layer of the empire's population. He was a Baltic German nobleman whose family had a storied history within the broader history of European nobilities and a very influential history within the Russian noble establishment, going back to the very beginning of Russian power in the Baltic in the early 18th century. So he's definitely a special guy. And like so many noblemen of his generation, he was, in a sense, cosmopolitan from the start. You know, even before he got into his diapers, when he was just an idea in his parents' minds, he was already all but fated to be a person who would live between the cultures. His father was a Baltic German nobleman. Brought up and schooled within the ways of the Russian Empire. His mother was a German noblewoman who had deep family connections to Austria, and that explains why at the time of his birth the family was living in the small town of Graz, which is in the region of Styria in southern Austria. But right from the start, in effect, he was like so many noblemen of his generation and ethnically German noblemen in particular, a person who mixed up a variety of worlds. In this case, the Habsburg Empire, the world of the nascent German Empire, and of Russia as well.
The Tsar will take many of his generals from outside of mainland Russia. What does that say about Russian relationships and the imperial Russian relationships with Europe more generally? And why is it the majority of generals are coming from nobility from Europe as opposed to nobility from, say, in the Far East, if that is accurate?
Mm-hmm. Well, no, the Russian officer class was fundamentally a cosmopolitan, multinational. The Russian Empire was a cosmopolitan operation at its highest level. One of the great elements of Russian success over the years in terms of empire building, of expanding both the territory and the broader influence of the empire, was the willingness of the Russian establishment to open itself to the elites of new regions where the empire was seeking to go. In fact, it found in those elites very willing partners, largely because the terms of the Russian Empire presented were broadly favorable. That is to say, the Russian Empire was certainly never a single thing. It changed in different ways over the centuries, but the arrangements made within elite politics were eerily consistent across the broad imperial period. In a nutshell, the empire would show up and come to terms with the people in charge. It could show up in a variety of ways, through war, through diplomatic parleys leading to effective annexation, through marital alliances that would bring in new territories. But one way or another, once the empire showed up, deals were made with elites on the ground, bringing them into the broader structures of the Russian nobility, allowing them to maintain, in many cases, all of their wealth and privileges, but just reorienting their allegiance away from whoever was in charge prior to the Russian arrival and now towards the Russian Tsar. And that's very much what happened with the nobilities of Russia's European fringe. And the Baltic German nobles were among the most successful and ultimately the most favored in the Russian imperial establishment. They, even though it was never the majority of Russian nobles, never the majority of Baltic German nobles who actually picked paths of serving in the Russian government, either in the army or in the civilian administration, those Baltic German nobles who did became, in many cases, extremely influential, extremely visible. The Ungern Sternbergs were a storied family in the broader Baltic German nobility. They were one of the foundational families, and they had tremendous pedigree within the Russian system. So many of Ungern Sternberg's relatives on his father's side and on his stepfather's side, because at an early point in his childhood, his parents divorced, his mother remarried, she married another baron who also came from a fairly storied family. Between those two families together, we find scores of men trained in the most elite schools of the empire and going on to impressive ranks in Russian service, whether in the military or otherwise. So Ungern, in many respects, is a symbol of the creative adaptability of the Russian Empire as it expanded into new regions, the terms on which it would make its accords for power with local elites. And Ungern shows just how mutually beneficial these arrangements could be, because ultimately, obviously, by the end of his life, he's willing to put everything into maintaining the empire that in some very basic sense ruled over him, but which he came to serve so completely that he identified with it as the only acceptable way of life for Eurasians.
Van Ungern comes to St. Petersburg at a ripe age of 17. He comes to enroll in the military academy. And by 1905, during the first, failed Russian Revolution, he's already in the military academy. Soon thereafter, he'll find himself in eastern Russia towards China. So I was wondering if you could explain to me exactly what are the ambitions of the Russian Empire moving eastward? And it seems to me that it's only with the advent of the railroad and railroad vehicles that this movement is possible, because of the terrain, because of the dense forests in Russia, and because of the enormous size of it. So how is it that he comes from Austria to St. Petersburg and ends up very shortly thereafter in going towards China? And what are the ambitions there? Why exactly is he traveling?
Right. Well, that's a great question. And in a very basic sense, it's central to the way I approach his story, because the reason that I seized upon Ungern as a protagonist, as someone who could lead me into the history of the empire, is precisely because he combines both extremities, the West and the East. And as he takes us into, on the one hand, fraught borderlands of the Baltic, Poland, Central Europe, and on the other, East Asia in particular, the broader Russian Far East and Mongolia, you come to see the continuities of the problems facing Russian imperial managers and the continuities of problems on the ground for all kinds of much more ordinary people living around borders and caught up within the great political movements that were sort of changing those borders. But Ungern, as I was saying earlier, he belonged to a special community of people, people who were, in a very basic sense, predisposed to mobility. And by his time, in part, indeed, because of the Trans-Siberian Railroad, could imagine a much easier latitude of movement within the empire, one that would bring these two ends of the country, separated by over 5,000 miles of distance, and like you said, in some cases pretty hard terrain, would bring those ends much, much, much closer together, both psychologically and practically, in terms of moving people, goods, and the rest. So his moment is in many respects, let's say, the moment of his life, a period of a great Asian turn. I think I use that reference in my book. There's a sort of preoccupation with questions about a Russian power in Asia, an openness in certain limited terms anyway, to understanding East Asian cultures, to engaging with them, to making sense of Russia as an Asian power, as an Asian culture. Ungern, I believe, like many young people of his generation, was in some very profound way sort of touched by this stirring. And he followed his ambitions in regards to Asia through the structures that were most obvious to him, most logical given his upbringing and formation. And that those really are the structures of the Tsarist army. So he or the Tsarist military more generally, because when he first ends up in St. Petersburg as a young boy, having proved himself to be a pretty miserable student in a Russian gymnasium in Reval, which was the head city of the old Russian province of Estland, which becomes, in effect, the basis for what emerges slightly later as the modern state of Estonia. After being effectively kicked out there, his parents decide to try and whip him into shape by sending him to military school in St. Petersburg. And the first military school he stops in is actually the Naval School of Naval Cadets, which is a very storied history in the Russian Empire going back to the time of Peter the Great. Proves himself to be a pretty miserable student there too, but in a sense he's sort of saved by the great events of the day, because the great disturbance of 1905 sort of unfolds or begins to unfold outside his windows there in his elite academy in St. Petersburg. He finds himself, again, effectively thrown out of school for being a pretty miserable student, but he takes advantage of the fact that the Russian Empire soon finds itself not just in the chaos of revolution, but embroiled in war with Japan, to enlist as a volunteer. And as best I can tell from looking at the trajectories of his life, it's in 1905 as a humble private volunteer that he first ends up on the far eastern borders of the Russian Empire. He serves for a period in the Russian Imperial Army in Manchuria. He gets to the front of the Russian war with Japan after peace talks have begun. In fact, he arrives just in time for an awful lot of mud and boredom. There's no fighting. But it's clear that that period was a very impressive occasion for him, even though we have no writing to speak to any of this change. It just seems that it couldn't help but have affected him because of all that comes next. In effect, as the war winds down, and his division is ultimately repatriated, sent back to European Russia, he returns to school in St. Petersburg. Same kind of elite academy, except now he switched from the Navy to the Army. And even though he hardly becomes the valedictorian, he really straightens up. His grades improve. And most strikingly, his conduct at school improves, because his earlier conduct books were full of all kinds of transgressions which got him into perennial trouble. But now, after having come back from the Far East and presumably grown up a little bit and focused himself on a new goal, he is absolutely perfect in terms of his behavior. And he achieves what must have seemed to his parents a few years earlier as the almost impossible goal of actually graduating from its military academy. And he becomes a young officer in the Russian army, and he chooses, and here's final proof, I think, even though we don't, again, have anything written down, but final proof that his experiences in the Far East profoundly changed him. He chooses for his first assignment a position with the Trans-Baikal Cossack Host, which is a special force of, in effect, frontier soldiers. In this case, serving on the border between the Russian Empire and the Empire of China, on the edges of what the Chinese refer to as Outer Mongolia. So he purposefully chose to return towards places that he knew out east. And even though we don't know what stirrings took place within him, I'm positing from sort of following his movements and connecting these changes that something profound took place, not just that broader emerging fascination with East Asia that we know was alive in Russian society and certainly in the Russian power establishment, but also his concrete experiences that must have turned his head and focused him on pursuing a career out there as a young man, as a young officer.
The Russian Empire is so big and St. Petersburg comparatively is so small that in the growth of the Russian Empire, they had to have interacted with all sorts of people living in what is mainland Russia. And the, a huge group of this is the Cossacks themselves, the ones that Urnian will soon join. What effect do they have on Urnian, and what effect do they have on the Russian Empire? How does the Russian Empire want to fit, because they know they can't push them aside because they're so powerful, such a powerful force in the country. So how do they adapt the Cossacks to work for or to function within the larger Russian Empire that would be loyal perhaps to the Tsar? So how does this interaction take place? And if you could talk maybe more about Urnian and his experience with the Cossacks.
Sure. I mean, one of the most interesting aspects of Urnian's story for me was the opportunity to explore the content of Cossack history, not in those regions where we know Cossacks best, which is the region that I studied much more closely in my first study on the Russian steppe, that is the Cossacks of the Don, the Cossacks of the lower Volga and Ural rivers, the Cossacks of the North Caucasus, the Cossacks of old Ukraine, but different Cossacks altogether, the Cossacks that were ultimately established for service on the borders of the Russian Empire in Siberia and what becomes later the Russian Far East. And in fact, they're very different Cossack histories for all the continuities of broader Cossack tradition. There's some really important differences between the original hosts in European Russia. And host is a term is used in reference to Cossacks to describe broader Cossack community, both as a military organization and as an administrative unit. Well, the old hosts of Europe, of the European side of Russia, they came together somewhat organically. You know, Cossacks, as best we can tell, were a motley collection of very ordinary folks, runaways, wanderers, Slavs, but also Turks or Turkic nomads, who create in effect, independent communities just beyond the reach of the states around them, beyond the reaches of Muscovy, beyond the reaches of Poland and the Ottomans. And ultimately, as the centuries progress, they find themselves sort of pinched between these states, serving different ones at different times. And ultimately, when the Russian Empire wins the great game for the European steppe, fought out with its rivals, they begin to transform the Cossacks from unruly, independent frontier contractors into servitors of the Tsar. Well, if we move from the European side of the empire to the Asian side, what you find is a history of Cossackdom that's much more shaped by this ethic of service and by the empire taking advantage of Cossack communities to serve on the borders of the Russian East. The Cossacks that Ungern joins, they are much like the Cossacks of the other side of the empire, made up of all kinds of ordinary people who are mixing along a border. There's no special preoccupation with making sure that everybody is ethnically Russian, or even for that matter, Russian Orthodox. The Cossacks are fundamentally cosmopolitan and multi-ethnic, multi-confessional. That's the point I'll talk about a little bit more in a moment. But in the case of the Cossack orders of the hosts of the of Siberia and the East, these are Cossack groups that are in effect put together by the Russian state. They're organized by the state to serve the purposes of the state on its distant borders. And basically, a very simple deal is struck. Cossacks are given land, told that they can take advantage of that land for their own households. But at the same time, every adult male in the Cossack household, between a certain range of years, has to provide a horse and has to provide himself for service on the frontier. In effect, the state helps to create a class of sort of farmer warriors, farmer soldiers. And by the very late 19th century, these Cossack hosts are all but formalized as units of the Russian Empire. They have their own special traditions. They have their own reasonable separateness from the rest of the army. But in many respects, they're treated like army divisions. And when Ungern arrives for his first stint as a Cossack officer in 1908, he is following in the footsteps of many other officers of his generation dispatched from the capitals to serve in these distant areas. And what's curious for me, given Ungern's background, is that he also reminds us of the variety of cosmopolitan communities that existed within the empire, and that in all kinds of instances, like the instance of his life, actually found themselves in a curious cohabitation. Because Ungern belonged to the world of a cosmopolitan nobility, in particular, the cosmopolitan nobility of the Russian Baltic Germans. But in a more in a broader sense, it's of the imperial nobility. By traveling east as a young officer and joining a Cossack host, in this case the Transbaikal Cossack host, he also signed up for cosmopolitan service. He joined another incredibly ethnically diverse social community. The Transbaikal Cossacks were overwhelmingly Russian Orthodox, but they had a large minority of Tungus and Buryat members who were, in terms of their religious practice, Buddhist or animist or shamanist in their persuasions. Everybody spoke at least some Russian, but Buryats and Tungus spoke their own languages, and the Russian Cossacks working with them, in many cases, worked freely in those languages as well. They shared habits of their household economies. They shared habits of dress. They intermarried. Ungern reminds us of how a variety of mixings of cosmopolitanism, I guess I'd say, some of them quite high-born and others very ordinary, very run-of-the-mill, could mix together. And it's somewhere in that mixing that we can find some of the special glue of the empire. It's not the only thing that explains the way the empire works, but there's something in that mixing that gives us a clue as to what held it together.
We find out later in the book that that von Ungern struggles with religion at one at a later point in his life. He goes back and forth between Buddhism and Orthodoxy, and back and forth and back and forth. Is this a result of him having spent so much time with the Cossacks, which were very cosmopolitan, and even though his original upbringing was within the noble cosmopolitanism, it's still very much similar, while maybe ethnically and nationally different. This new cosmopolitan group that he's with, the Cossacks, come from different social structures. They're racially different. They have different languages, and it's very much more diverse group than he's used to. So does this affect his personal convictions?
Yeah, I mean, obviously, as a nobleman, he was exposed to a particular sort of cosmopolitan environment, you know, a group, you know, various subcultures of people who spoke a variety of languages, who traveled broadly, who thought of themselves as worldly people. In finding himself among the Cossacks of first the Baikal and later the Russian Far East, he indeed, as I said earlier, found himself in another cosmopolitan community, but you know, the cosmopolitanism there is very, very different, obviously. And we should be probably a little more careful about using the word. I mean, I certainly don't mean that the Cossacks that he was serving with on these pretty remote frontiers thought of themselves in relation to the world with the same sort of cosmopolitan ethos that Ungern would have run into in the very, very privileged schools and the parlors of his youth. But what he did find was a culture of, Cossack culture, a broader border culture of incredible mixing and transit and interaction between different groups and different religions. And my sense, again, without having Ungern's own writings to guide us through his thoughts, my sense is that what he ultimately brought to this particular frontier for himself was a fascination with Asia, a quest to make sense of Asia as a special sort of terrain for the future of the empire, and I think by the end of his life, for the future of the world entire. And it was out of that curiosity, which I think this curiosity for Asia that I believe was sort of built into his age and that he must have imbued in different ways, and then found himself sort of confronted with as a young man because he was serving in these places. It's that combination of both curiosity of his broader cultural formation and then the opportunity of his service that I think created a path into a certain amount of religious experimentation, of borrowing between cultures, of seeking to learn and use Mongolian, and as far as I can tell as well, a little bit of Chinese, of consulting shamans, of praying at Buddhist temples, while at the same time never formally renouncing his upbringing as a Lutheran, while at the same time, too, apparently, even though I haven't found the smoking gun documentation that most historians would probably want, but apparently agreeing to a Orthodox marriage with a Manchu woman in Harbin in the years of the Russian Civil War. So he is an incredibly complex figure in terms of his personal religious politics. But I guess what's useful for him, for me, is and for anybody interested in the empire, is that I think he's revealing of a wide range of choices made by all kinds of people. Many people were much lower born than him, who operated within these frontier or border environments and had an opportunity to sort of combine religions, borrow between languages and broader material and popular cultures. And they became, as a result, fundamentally border people, I guess I'd say, multicultural people.
Burton goes to great lengths to learn about Asia, about the people he's interacting with. And the following question maybe perhaps come off as a little bit ahistorical, but what does Russia do wrong, the Russian Empire do wrong, which Ergen perhaps did right in learning about Asia and then being able to cohabitate with Asia? What, in another sense of the word, could Russia have learned from his efforts to assimilate into Asian culture and to assimilate, bring Russian and European cultures together with Asian cultures?
Yeah. Well, you know, it's too sweeping, obviously, to suggest that the empire got a whole sort of course of imperial politics completely wrong. But I think you're on to something in one respect. The arc of the Russian Empire followed from the 18th century into the 19th, and then the very early 20th century on the verge of what becomes the last catastrophic shaking of the empire and ultimately the demise of the royal house and the revolutions of 1917. You know, that arc shows you a move from a certain amount of success and confidence to repeated failures, or certainly difficulty with almost endless challenges of what you could call, in sort of business speak, multi-ethnic management. You know, broadly speaking, you could conclude that the first Russian imperial managers were better at the job than the last ones. But of course, going into that critical period of Ungern's life, the last few decades of the empire, and thinking about the way the empire was managed and getting down to seeing what was going wrong, you also find an awful lot that was going right or that was going much as it had always gone. And Ungern, in many respects, is hardly making up a solution for the empire's future. He's actually living, in many respects, the empire's past. I mean, the Russian Empire survived and, in some respects, thrived for generations by creating all kinds of open space for a certain kind of practical toleration, practical mixing of peoples. And obviously within that space. There were some very, very clear deals made, as I suggested earlier, with regional elites. And there were very clear limits placed by imperial authorities to the degree of toleration that was permitted and the degree of autonomy allowed to the regions. Ungern, by empire's end, finds himself in a system that in some ways is just as permissive as before, with this sort of, I guess I'd say, bracketed permissiveness that defined the empire, the laissez-faire imperialism that I talk about towards the end of the book. In some respects, this older empire, really centuries-old way of imperial living, is still at work in the way all kinds of people function within the state. But there's also a new tendency to sort of tighten things up. You mentioned earlier the phenomenal impact of the Trans-Siberian Railroad. It's a reminder of the great technological changes of the late imperial era that were sort of tightening up the empire as a series of connected spaces, allowing for much more movement and much faster movement, much more regular movement between the different parts of the empire. And that sort of technological, I would say, sort of tightening up or fastening of the empire was accompanied by policies that sought to give a greater standardization to the empire, to make sure that more people were formed into a kind of Russian way of looking at the world, that more people, given any kind of choice, would become Russian Orthodox. To make sure that the administration of the state was more streamlined so that everybody was, in effect, going to court the same way, posting a letter in the same fashion. And that meant, in a very basic sense, undoing many of the regional particularities of the state. So Ungern found himself in a sense, two empires at once. He was in this much older empire of a certain amount of flexibility and creative adaptation to the fundamental reality of multi-ethnicity and multi-confessionality, the multicultural quality of the empire. He lived within all the practical compromises that were required to make that work. And at the same time, he also inhabited this other empire that was tightening things up, trying to standardize things, trying to Russianize them more. This and in many respects, again, if we want to come back to a big generalization, which is very useful sometimes, we could say that it was the combination of these empires that they're sort of in some regards actually slamming together that helped to create the imperial crisis that ultimately undid the state. So, you know, what did they get wrong? What did they get right? It's hard to say because it was such a complex scene. But I think these two basic ways of imperial living were at work in Ungern's life, and it's very clear that we can see both in him because he's such a Russianized fellow, and at the same time he's operating with a broad sense of cultural flexibility, oriented around a Russian center, around a vision of the Russian Empire defined by Tsarism.
Let's go towards the end of Ungern's life and his role in trying to keep together the monarchy, which he very much intended to do. He was very loyal to the monarchy. So what is his role towards the end of his life, towards the early 1920s? I believe he dies in 1921. What is his role in shaping, in trying to convince the people of the steppe and people in Asia to continue believing in and being loyal to the monarchy? And then we can move into his ultimate demise and how it is that his empire crumbled and he crumbled himself.
Right. Well, yeah, I mean, you know, I guess I'd say exhibit number one in the case to prove how successful the empire was in creating Ungern as an imperial servant has to be his really undying monarchism, his absolute devotion to the ideal of the rule of the Tsar, not as an ethnic Russian overlord, but as the symbol of a unified space connecting Europe and Asia, connecting the religions of the West and of the East, connecting all the peoples in between. I mean, if the Russian Empire was going to survive, it definitely needed imperial servitors like Ungern, who believed in the fundamental necessity of the Tsarist order. And that was really, I think, his abiding faith by the end of his life. I believe, again, without having too much to go on in terms of his own writings on this score, that this was a formation laid very early within his deepest upbringing and then cemented in the formal schooling that he received in some of the most elite educational establishments of the empire, and then, of course, repeated during his years of military service because the Russian officer class was created to serve the regime. And it's, in fact, one of the very important, I guess, stumblings of the old order, that by the time of World War I, as the war accelerated in its destructiveness, the Russian officer corps changed profoundly. It had already been changing considerably prior to the war, but during the war it changed profoundly because of the enormous scale of death and destruction. And ultimately you end up with an officer class that is much, much more divided in its sympathies towards the Tsar. And it's this division that helps to explain some of the unraveling of the Tsarist order. What had been for centuries established as the absolute loyal class became a class riven with questions about loyalty. Now, they didn't affect Ungern. Ungern remained loyal to the end. But some of his protestations, I think, were fired by the fact that he was, certainly by the end of his life, confronted with the fact there were an awful lot of people, even people like him, who no longer believed quite the way he did, who had abiding questions about the Tsarist order. Why did he embrace the ideal of Tsarism as a message to take to Eastern peoples? Now, that's a really valuable question because it opens up a broader view of the politics of Russian imperial history, not just in East Asia, but throughout the empire. I think he turned to the Tsarist ideal for the very practical reason that for centuries that ideal had worked. There was a broad understanding within this old-fashioned empire that I was describing a little bit earlier, that for all of this to hold together, for the tremendous diversity to work itself out, for the completely disproportionate distribution of wealth and power, for the tremendous unevenness between the regions in terms of their economies and really their position vis-a-vis the center and the outside world, for all of this diversity and complexity to hold together, you needed one fixed point. And that fixed point was the Tsar. It wasn't the Tsar as a Russian or even a Russian Orthodox figure, though obviously in the old Orthodox empire, there was no question that the Tsar would be Orthodox. But what was abidingly important in Ungern's embrace of the Tsarist ideal for Eastern peoples was the sense of the emperorness of the emperor, that he represented the center of this vast state that could be a kind of sheltering sky for everybody within it. And that language of imperial power worked to a degree with Russians as well, even though we know that Russian society was riven by the time of the revolution with all kinds of questions of the viability of Tsarist rule. It's less clear that people felt that there was no place for central rule at all. In fact, if we want to look just a little bit ahead, we see how ultimately the revolution plays into the hands of radical socialists, the Bolsheviks, who become ferocious centralizers, even though they too make their own accommodations with the diversity of the empire, recreating that empire in a new form. They're remarkable centralizers, and they speak to the abiding virtues of having a center that will sort of hold it all together. So I think it's this persuasion that for the complexity of this world to remain intact and functional, you need a center point. And for Ungern, there was no other center but the Tsar.
It's really interesting that you bring this this question of a central government and a central Tsar, because it keeps reappearing in the context of Russia and its empire-ness. Of course, the central power in the 40s was held in Moscow. And more recently, 100 years after what you've written in the book, just recently, I don't know if you've seen this yourself, Zhirinovsky, this joker by most accounts in the Russian government, has spoken out about how Russia, in order to be powerful again, needs, even if it comes in a dictatorious way, a central empire, a strong emperor, even if this emperor is Putin. So I wonder if you could talk about the cost of an empire and how an empire spreads, and essentially the, as we talked about earlier, the fragility of borders and borderlands, and whether or not what we're seeing today happen in Russia is the beginning or maybe the intentions of a new empire, of a continuation of an old empire, and what your thoughts are from learning, from studying old empires about what is happening today.
Well, you know, I think an interesting place to start this sort of ruminating on the meaning of empire in the Russian context in our time is really the end of Ungern's story, because he ultimately comes to define a vision of a future a world of empires, sitting in his sort of frontier outpost in Outer Mongolia. And for folks who haven't yet, for readers who haven't yet had a chance to look at the book and don't know necessarily how Ungern's story ends up, it's really the end of his life that's known at all. I mean, there are a number of studies written about Ungern, in part because the last few months of his life are so dramatic. You know, he ends up in fighting on the side of the whites in the Russian Civil War in eastern Siberia. When the whites front against the reds breaks down, he's in the Transbaikal and he's in charge of, you know, a thousand or so men, most of them cavalry. And even though most of the other whites in the region are moving farther east, ultimately to the Russian Far East or into Russian Manchuria, like the great city of Harbin that becomes one of the centers of the Russian white emigration, Ungern goes into Outer Mongolia. And in Outer Mongolia, he sets himself up as, in effect, a resurrector of empires. And he begins with envisioning the resurrection of the Qing Empire through, interestingly enough, re-enthronement of the ruler of Mongolia, the Bogda of Mongolia, whom Ungern envisioned as a kind of imperial servitor. Mongolia had been ruled for centuries from Beijing, as in effect a region of the Qing Empire, and Ungern envisioned recreating this relationship that had been undone by the tremendous chaos of the Chinese Revolution that was occurring in roughly the same historical moment as the Russian one. But as Ungern began, in the first instance, placing the Bogda back on the throne, communicating with potential supporters influential leaders in the broader Mongolian and Manchurian regions, he also began envisioning how this repairing of the imperial system in East Asia would connect to a resurrection of empire in Russia. And it's this sort of fixation on his role in sort of returning empire to Russia that ultimately leads to his demise, because he takes his troops from Mongolia in the spring, summer of 1921 onto a war footing in what turns into a pretty miscalculated campaign against the Reds in eastern Siberia. He's ultimately captured and then hauled back to western Siberia, where he's put on trial by the Bolsheviks in one of the early show trials. And shortly thereafter, he's executed. In dispatching Ungern, the Bolsheviks are very clearly, in their mind, dispatching the old regime. They're dispatching everything that was wrong about old Russia, represented by this brutal imperial warlord. But the point I make in the book is that there's a kind of irony in Ungern's ending, because even though he's an imperialist of an old order, who clearly has to be condemned by the new, and this new order is sort of fundamentally anti-imperialist. It sort of defines itself as being against empires. Empires are exploitative, capitalistic. They're doomed to the ash heap of history. The very people who are condemning empire are themselves living within its traditions and ultimately going to find themselves facing the same questions of how to make imperial space cohere. And ultimately, to make a very complicated story short, the Bolsheviks who pillory and then execute Ungern ultimately come to create an imperial state of their own by a very different name, organized in very different ways than the preceding empire, but also with dramatic continuities with that old order. If we speed up from that time, the end of the old Russian Empire, to the very earliest formation of the new Soviet state, a kind of successor to the Russian Empire, if we move from those very tumultuous times to our own, some 20 or so years after the Soviet Union has collapsed, I think to understand the sort of place of empire in contemporary Russian politics requires thinking through the way empire has been reckoned in the 20th century, and especially since the ending of the Soviet state. During the Soviet period, there was almost nothing good that you could say about the Russian Empire as a political form. I mean, there was some glory to Russian arms. There was some wisdom to Russian rulers. There was a natural way in which the different peoples in the empire should live together, because ultimately they were still living together, many of them, in the Soviet state. But empire itself was a bad word, because empire presumed relations of subordination, hierarchy, and exploitation. The Soviet Union was a multinational state. It was expressly not an empire. And it was held up as the right way to do multinational business, to run, in effect, a diverse combination of peoples and regions. When the Soviet Union collapses, in many respects due to its own internal contradictions, one of which was the contradiction of nationality and central power, there really, how would I put it, a kind of vacuum develops in the way the broader Russian public and the power establishment thinks about the course of the Russian future. You know, what legacy are we really going to draw on? The Soviet legacy didn't seem to work. The Russian imperial legacy had been largely delegitimized through the course of the Soviet period. If you look at the 90s, you find this curious seesawing, zigzagging, looking for how to make sense of this past, none of which seemed entirely usable. Until really, I believe, the ascent of Putin to the Russian presidency, when some things become a little bit clearer. A kind of marriage of convenience is made with regards to the strikingly different structures of the Russian past. On the one hand, it becomes now entirely permissible, not just because Putin said so, but because more and more people are feeling this way in the Russian public and in the Russian political establishment, to embrace the glory and the achievement of the Russian Empire, to embrace the legacy of empire that I think in its most obvious form becomes a kind of imperial nostalgia for an awful lot of educated Russians, both inside and outside of government. To marry that vision of a sort of mostly good Russian empire, speaking to the glory and sort of creativity of Russian elites, to marry that to also a kind of veneration for the Soviet achievement, which was, as I was mentioning before, a very different way of organizing multinational life. And to see in the Soviet achievement a kind of fulfillment of the best aspects of Russia's imperial history, and also the resolution of some of its darker chapters, its darker aspects. What you don't have in any of this, though, is a real airing of the complexities of empire. There's a kind of imperial mystique that's embraced about the distant Russian past, and on the part of the power establishment, very clearly, a resonating towards the achievement of Russian power over such an enormous territory and over so many different peoples. But there's not much questioning of how this works, the nitty-gritty of it all. On the one hand, there's not much engagement with the abuses of empire, with the tremendous costs in blood and treasure of running such a gigantic state, facing all the challenges that Russia faced in its history of a difficult climate, a poor infrastructure, a relatively small population for such an enormous territory. There's not much reckoning with the complexities and the violence, the costly shortcuts that are embraced to make this thing work. By the same token, there's also, I would say, and this is also a real loss for the broader Russian public, or for all of us, really. There isn't much reckoning with the broader, I would say, ordinary achievements of this empire. The ones that we see a little bit in Ungern's life, the mixing of different peoples, the way in which the empire didn't just exist as a series of policies and glorious imperial rituals in the capital, but it existed actually in ways of cohabitation that were created over, in some cases, centuries of interaction between different groups under a common roof, the common roof provided by Russian Tsarism. You know, that complexity, and there was tremendous complexity there, is itself an achievement of empire. It should be, I think, part of the reckoning of the story of empire that could, in some respects, be turned in a fairly positive direction. You know, but it too, I would argue, is not really part of the way that empire is considered in Russia today. So we end up with a curiously disembodied understanding of empire, I would say. You know, empire is just this big space on the map full of all these different kinds of people, with Russians in the middle and brilliant Russians on top. But the stuff of the empire, what made it work, what made it fail, ultimately, that's not really examined. And there isn't much room in Russian public discourse for that kind of inquiry as well. So when we zip forward and find ourselves in the incredible intensity of the conflict between Russia and Ukraine, starting with the simmering and then explosive protests in Kiev, moving then to the Russian assertion of its power over Crimea, and as far as the Russians are concerned, its reunification with Russia, and as far as the Ukrainians and many of us in the West are concerned, its annexation by a foreign state, all the way to today, when we see, in effect, the most messy and bloody of sort of proxy wars being fought in eastern Ukraine. You don't find any real engagement with the history, the very, very complicated history that's created this region. There's a sort of facile reference to that history, but there isn't a readiness to engage, in my view, the fullness of how these regions and the peoples of these regions held together for centuries. And consequently, it's a fairly sterile discussion. The empire that's used in Russian parlance today really doesn't look like the empire that I study. It's nowhere near as awesome in its power or as limited in its reach, and it's certainly nowhere near as complex in the cohabitation of peoples. And I think that is a loss, because if that were in the public debate, I think there'd be more terms for us to use in thinking about a solution to where borders should be, where citizenship should lie, and what peoples can live in the state and which peoples cannot.
So, but before we do wrap up, we'd like to ask you what you're working on currently as your next project, perhaps after Baron's Cloak.
Well, thank you. Yes. Well, I've long been interested in Russia's history as an empire, and fascinated by the way in which so many different peoples come together in this space. With my new book, I'm turning to a study of early 18th century Russia, and I'm going to use the remarkable period of the rule of Peter the Great to try and explore questions of Russia's engagement with the world. Because from so much study over the years of Russia's modern history, I've been drawn to the period of the late 17th and early 18th century as a time of revolution, of sort of reordering of Russian life in some ultimately very profound ways, that was also coupled to the country's new engagement with the world around it, with other societies, other states. And the goal of my new project, which I'm tentatively calling Peter's Horizons, is a study of the way in which different imperial Russians, not just ethnic Russians, and different kinds of subjects, including foreign subjects of the Russian Empire in the time, sort of created this new way of placing the empire in the world that I believe ultimately had, you know, very, very powerful consequences for the evolution of the country over the next 200 years. So that's what I'm working on now. In some respects, I'm sort of staying within the range of issues that have long fascinated me, but I'm sort of approaching them in a new way, in a new period.
Thanks so much for joining us on New Books Network.
Well, thanks a lot. It was really enjoyable to talk to you a little bit about my book and about all the interesting issues that are a part of Russia's imperial history. So thanks.
This has been a production of the New Books Network. Please join us again soon.